Jason, you're going to have to edit this thing to death.
Do you know the author?
No, I don't, and I don't know the title either. But it's a blue book, and it kind of gives the whole story, you know.
Have you a real love of books and learning?
Of Adventures in Library Instruction. This is Anna Vanskoyk, a part-time reference librarian for County Library System in New Jersey. And I am joined today by my fabulous co-producers. I'm going to let them go ahead and introduce themselves. Jason?
Hey, this is Jason Puckett at GSU Library in Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm on Twitter at @librarianjason, and I occasionally blog at jasonpuckett.net.
And I am Rachel Borchard. I'm the science librarian at American University. And as usual, I do not blog, but I tweet at Butternut Squash.
We are very fortunate today to have a guest with us, and it is Mary McDonald, who is the Head of Instructional Services and Information Literacy Librarian at the University of Rhode Island. She is also, you're an associate professor, aren't you, Mary? Is that right?
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
For the university. She has co-authored a few books, The Teaching Information Literacy, 50 Practical Standards-Based Exercises, which just came out this year. And she was also the co-author for Creating a Comprehensive Information Literacy Plan. So, Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. We really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Double so.
We had a little bit of a little bit of a very large glitch and lost our entire first crack at this. So, yeah, extra thanks to Mary for coming back and re-recording. So we'll see how this goes today.
So Dana over at the Wiggle Room podcast can totally appreciate this because this just happened to her recently. So
It's just right. Their episode 2, they totally lost the recording and had to re-record. So
well, you know, technology is only good when it works. So.
Exactly.
So, okay, so we have a couple of things we want to talk about today. We want to talk about your URI 101 class, the library information literacy components of that, and I would love to talk a little bit about the second edition of Teaching Information Literacy, which is a terrific book that I'm partway through and haven't finished.
Thank you so much. You want to talk about the URI 101, we have a live guide up on our university library website for URI 101, which is a one-credit class that most freshmen take called Traditions and Transformations, and it is an introduction to university life. For freshmen, it covers a myriad of people, places, things, services that students need to know about. And since 1995, when the course was invented, the library has had a part of that course, which is only a one session piece, but it's a 15-week, one-hour-a-week kind of course. So we feel it's really important to get the students in, and we've tried everything from teaching them how to use the catalog to just a warm welcome, and we're at the warm welcome stage at this point. So and we'll talk about why that happened. But this year, we combined a lot of information from various web pages on our site and created a live guide, and I have to give all credit to that creation to my colleague Amanda Eisenstark, who I co-run the URI 101 program with.
Mary, is there a research component to this course? I mean, are they actually writing a research paper as part of the course?
No, we do wish they would, but right. That's not the focus of the course. A lot of the focus is on service learning. That takes quite a bit of time for them. And I have, you know, we've talked with the directors of that program about it, but they think the logistics would be hard. Mm-hmm. I don't, but, you know, you have to come to a middle ground when you're working with another department, another college. It's university colleges where all our freshmen enter mm-hmm. and are there for their first between, could be 30 to 60 credits depending on the program. So we really have to meet them. And that was part of my frustration when I started doing this in 2007, taking over from another colleague, was that I wanted to reinvent the wheel, and I realized that I had to kind of go in the tracks that had been set before uh-huh. me, you know, so we're moving slowly. But at this point, the students' classes come in, and the classes can range anywhere from maybe 10, 12 students to as many as 36 because they are grouped by learning community or by major. So, it, you know, if there are a lot of marine affairs majors or a lot of textiles department majors, that will determine the size of the class. So what we've done is try to streamline both for our purposes and for the URI 101 faculty purposes a session that will work for everyone. And that's where you see all the pieces on the LibGuide. Of course, that's not everything we cover, but it's a good place for us to bounce off and as well to fill in gaps later on when mm-hmm. the students leave the session.
When I first saw that, because I think that I was the one who initially had the question about this, because when I first saw it, I'm like, is this kind of a tutorial that they have on? Because it's almost like an FAQ on getting started.
Well, it's used in conjunction with the Cephalonian method, which some of you may have heard about. It's being used across the country. And I got a lot of information about Cephalonian from Marinda Hensley at Illinois, who, you know, told me how she had been using it. And are you familiar with it?
Mm-hmm. We used it.
Anna loves it.
Question answers. And, what a lot of schools have questions and answers. Well, the questions that are created and given to the students. So you might have, we have 26 cards with questions that we know that they need to know, they might ask, things that we've gotten perennially from the freshman class, and we color-coded them by area that we would be either visiting physically or coded by in, like most important things to know about right. the catalog or, you know, so forth and so on. And we actually coded them by the colors of the rainbow so that we would not get lost ourselves. we also have a bunch of graduate students that work for us, and it made it easier for them to catch on to the system and the class program so that they wouldn't have a hard time jumping into it at a moment's notice. But we use the Cephalonian method, and the students like it. We've just, in fact, since I spoke with you last, we had sent out a very short 5-question survey to faculty of the URI 101 program, asking them how they like the new program and things that they might want to change about it. The results have been pretty positive so far, with probably about over 50% seeing it as a big improvement from things that we've done in the past. So, I don't know, there's a lot to it, because one of the reasons that we changed it this year was that we did not have desktop computers. We didn't have any computers for the students to use because we are engaging in a construction project. So the classroom that we usually use was down. So that was the only way we could see fit to get any information to the students, was kind of to go with this new program style.
It sounds like that is something that we had done at Emory, where it was very much more kind of lectury, kind of this is what we have to offer you, about a 10-minute spiel.
Yeah.
And what the Cephalonian method, what I noticed, and maybe you noticed this also, is that, and we would have groups of maybe 100 students. Oh. It was huge.
Yeah.
But right. We were seeing every first-year student coming through.
And yeah, well, we don't get every single one, even though there's sort of a myth that it's required, but we know that there are a few students who manage to get out of it, so it could be just that their schedules don't allow for it. But we had over 2,300 students, so
yeah.
That's a
batch. But that's one of the things I wanted to know, is what kind of feedback or assessment you had done, because we had to go through, kind of like you, we were working with other departments, and we got like one question on the overall, because it's kind of like the same thing. It's that overall course that they're taking throughout the year. Huh? So we got one question on there, and I left, and so I never really got the students' feedback, but I like that you asked the faculty.
You have one question on the course assessment that the department who ran the course did.
Yes.
Saying, well, that's true. They do an assessment that way, and we get very limited information from that,
yeah,
that part of their assessment. But in the past few years, again, Amanda and I have been taking over this project since 2007. We, at first, we did a paper survey because we just were catching on rather slowly. The next year, we jumped into SurveyMonkey, and we've been able to get good information. But again, we had students doing hands-on exercises in an electronic classroom,
right.
So we got different kinds of information. So this year, we knew we weren't going to have any way for them to do an electronic assessment. So we didn't do the students, but we decided to focus again on the faculty and get kind of a different slant, seeing as that was the best way to go about it. So I don't have the final numbers yet, but looking at it over this past weekend, I see that they all want us to do, and there are enough things that they have suggested that we could create another course, you know, out of their suggestions.
Sure, of course.
Of course, you know. And so, you know, we'll make a summary statement saying that we loved all of your answers, and we'll try to respond to these the best way we can. But you know how that is.
Right.
But better too much feedback than none at all. I mean, at least you know they care.
Yeah, it's terrific. It's terrific. And many of them, the thing that I noted mostly was that they loved the improvement in student engagement based on the Cephalonian method, mm-hmm. where the students had to stay involved because, one, just basically they had to ask a question, but secondly, it gave them permission to ask more questions, and that's what we really wanted to have happen. So that worked. So that was great.
I have always been just sort of skeptical of Cephalonian. I mean, I know we tried it at Emory in orientation and everything, but everybody says it's such a great icebreaker and everything, so I guess I have to believe that. I have to drop some of my skepticism.
Well, you bring up a really good point, Jason. Now, you're a very personable guy, and so I don't think you'd have any problem with it, but you do have to be someone who can think on your feet, who enjoys conversing with freshmen, who isn't going to be tied to the podium and needs a script, because you really don't know how each question is going to play out.
Exactly. There's a lot of ad lib.
Even if you have a PowerPoint, which I've seen some fantastic examples online and people have shared with me, I know that each question is a conversation unto itself, and you need to know how to limit it so that you can get through all your questions but still be flexible enough to make it, you know, fresh. So it takes a little practice, but I think after you do a couple of them, you realize that it's your own conversation with that particular class, and the dynamic can be wonderful.
Then that's really just the beginning piece of your information literacy plan.
Oh yeah,
so to speak.
Oh, yeah, very. It's a baby step.
And I think that's one. It's funny because I can remember in all the conversations I've had, and even in job interviews, they're like, they always ask, this is the canned question, what are the three things you want your students to walk away with? And the first one tends to be, I want them to know where to go to get help. And that really is kind of what that welcome to the library kind of thing is about.
It really is. I tell people this is our opportunity to say, these are the physical and virtual library, people, place, services, opportunities that are here for you. We tell them it's their tuition dollars at work, that they are our bread and butter. We want them to come and ask us anything. One of the questions we have in the Cephalonian packet is, what kind of questions do you answer at the reference desk? Because we've seen, you know, that students circle the desk waiting to see if they are brave enough to come and ask a question, right? And I also say the reference desk is like the desk of last resort, right? We've read in the literature that students will Google, they will ask their parents, their friends, their teachers, and they're finally up against a wall. They'll be, maybe I'll go ask the librarian, because I know, you know, they will know. But, we're never quite sure where that hesitation comes. But it's there. We know it's there. So one of the things we tell students in the class is we answer everything. If you want to know where the bathroom is, we know. If you want to know how to use SciFinder Scholar, we know. So it's the continuum, and that's one of the things I want to get across to them.
Right. And then you go to URI's library's website, And there's your plan for information literacy, smack dab for anyone to go see. And that was something that we had kind of talked about last time, where a lot of people write up the information literacy plans, and it's kind of this internal document, and it's kind of shared amongst the departments, but I don't know if it's really shared outside of that, even with other departments, per se.
Why do you think that is? Why wouldn't you want to – why would somebody not post it?
I don't know. Because you could.
Because I think posting it – and we mentioned this last week, too. Not only is it – it's a piece of public relations in a sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
We did mention the fact that maybe only other librarians are looking at it, and that's possible. But if it does any service or good for them, then that's terrific. But I like it to be there. So that administrators might find it, so that the assessment office knows it's there, so that we all have, you know, we've agreed to it, we've approved it, we have voted on it, and it's part of what we do. It's who we are. We consider ourselves a teaching library, and we tell everyone that comes in that we only have 8 public services librarians and there are 16,000 students. So clearly we have to teach you how to find information and we'd be happy to do that at any time. We can't get it for you. So the information literacy plan, just it's kind of an affirmation of our goals. Let's face it, it's a plan. It's not everything on there has not been accomplished, but it's where we're headed. And we have done it. We've implemented most of it, but I just don't like people to think that every plan that you see online from any school is completely finished.
But I think more libraries should be putting their standards and their strategic plans and things like this online. Because, I mean, if nothing else, it helps us in our own research when we're trying to figure out what we're doing, you know, at for other librarians is what I'm trying to say.
It makes
researching these things so much easier because we can just, you know, find them on Google because it's up there on your website and not have to, you know, contact coordinators and so on. We've got, I forget what our document is called, Information Literacy Standards, I think is our document. It's not a plan, it's not an action plan as such, but it's sort of our, you know, desired learning outcomes sort of thing. You know, every GSU student should know how to do these things when they graduate, that sort of thing.
And I think, you know, we have a plan, but it's not completely fleshed out with – we have some of the programs in the plan have learning outcomes. Some don't. It's just a matter of time to sit down with each of the librarians who are responsible for a particular program and get that all hashed out, again, because they have to work with their faculty in the departments to work, you know, to make sure that everything's the way that they want it. So there's a lot of collaboration going on before anything can actually be approved and uploaded. But I do agree that the more we can make public our plans, it speaks a lot about who we are and our intentions. And it does help all of the other librarians that we're friendly with and people we don't know to think about pieces that might be useful for them. You know, I think I look at other people's plans and I'm like, wow, that's fabulous. And then someone will say that to me and I'm like, you know, we're all working toward the same goal but with different variables.
Right. And that's one thing that we kind of had talked about in conversation number one was that one plan doesn't necessarily fit another institution, that it really is more – there's more variables to it. There's something like a liberal arts school compared to a Research One institution – there's going to be different factors that are going to come into play.
Absolutely. Well, that's a misconception a lot of people have when they start to write a plan, that they have to fit all the standards in with all the performance indicators and the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And you can't do them all at once. You can't fit every outcome into every session that you do or every, you know, program. And that's where I think you have to sit down and strategize and think, what does our institution need for our students and what can we do best with the resources, and meaning staff, time, technology, and so forth? What's the best bang for the buck that we can get? And it really just boils down to making some logical decisions and trying not to shoot the moon and, you know, not getting anywhere.
Mary, one thing that I liked that you said during our last conversation was that one of the things to start with is, what do you already have?
Right.
And to write it all down and to get everyone on the same page. That
sure.
had never really occurred to me, that it's so much easier to figure out what those gaps are and how to fill them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because we're all doing terrific work. I mean, you know, if you've sat on any bus at ALA, any shuttle bus, and sat down at the table, which I do all the time, and find out, they'll say, oh, we need to do a plan. We need to do this big thing. I said, well, what are you doing now? You probably have half of it already done. Just have to put it in some kind of format that makes sense for your institution. And then, as you said, Rachel, you'll see where your gaps are, and you'll think, what can we do to address this need? And it doesn't have to be a full-blown, you know, expensive program to start with. Maybe you just want to start with something little to see if it will work. And I always tell people at meetings, there's never been a better word in the library profession than pilot program.
Oh, I love pilots.
Program, you know, it gives you the freedom to try things out and do a little assessment and see how it felt. How did it work? I mean, you might have gotten terrific response from the community, but maybe it burnt everybody out and it's just not going to be able to be sustainable. Or vice versa, maybe everybody loved it, but the community didn't respond well. Well, then you sit down and you look at you know, how you can dress it up or trim it down and make it fit. So a lot of it's just being practical.
We're calling a lot of stuff permanent beta around here lately.
I'm going to steal that from
you. Oh, please do. Yeah, yeah. I think we stole it from Google, so feel free.
Actually, our plan at our library, well, my dream at our library is to have something like the Google Labs and have, like, here's all the stuff that we're working on.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, an area where people can give us feedback. But similar to the pilot, like, we're trying stuff, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but that it's all open to the public.
Yeah.
We previously on our, we've redid our website this year, and we previously had a link that said beta, and it was like stuff that was in the works that we were trying out and new systems and things like that. And I think we lost that on the new version of the website. But I always kind of liked that we had just this link of stuff that said, you know, here we're trying out this new application. Here it is, and here's a feedback form, and we don't quite know what we're doing with it yet. But I always thought that was really cool.
It is.
I wonder if beta is more acceptable now. I just know back in the day when I was first – in library school, they would talk about how, and this is when, you know, I was, you know, a little graduate student working in the library, and there was this mindset, we don't want to offer services and then take them away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe with just how the internet has grown and the services, that mindset has changed, that it's okay to kind of try these things out, and, you know, maybe it'll be like Google Wave and just go away, you know, and it won't be there anymore.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that we used to think that Google would someday be finished. You know, the internet would be done and we would just know what to do with it. But clearly that's not going to happen. And so I think you're right on the money there that we have to be flexible enough to try things out.
Yeah.
And be brave, put a toe in the water, but pull back when it stops making sense.
And one of the things I like that you brought up is that what is the staff, the impact on the staff as well.
Yeah, I don't think we think about that often enough.
No, I agree.
I mean, even we'll sit to, everybody will be running by each other in the hallways, just, you know, you've probably seen it. You know, you have a meeting, you have a class, you have reference desk, you have another meeting. Did you eat lunch? No, not today. And that's okay September and October because, as we know, Adventures in Library Instruction land. That's the way it is. I always explain it to my family as this is tax season for librarians, so don't call me until Thanksgiving.
That's a good one. I'm going to use that one. So
they don't understand how we could possibly be so busy. But we'll say this is our busiest time of the year, and I don't go to movies or do a lot of extra stuff right now, you know. But I will, you know, we will. So, yeah, you have to think about your staff. And I think, you know, let's go back to the information literacy plan, or making anyone's plan, is when you think about staffing, it is a variable, a very important variable to how many different programs you can reasonably run and run well, effectively, with meaningful instruction for the students, because, of course, that is your primary goal, you know, whatever you can do for them to help them out. But look at your resources as staff. Look at your staff resources and see what are their strengths? You know, if you're really loaded with brilliant technology savvy folks, then maybe you can develop some learning objects and get them in on your website and share them with departments that could use them. And of course, sometimes you can create some basic learning objects. And when I say that, I mean, I've seen people call PowerPoints learning objects, which they can be, as and you can get as fancy as you want to be. And some things I don't even know about that are out there already. But, you know, make it work for you so that the staff you have can shine and use their talents. But if maybe they're not as tech-savvy a library, because there are some libraries that just don't have big staff, they don't have big money, they don't have the resources that they would love to have, there are other ways you could do it. So I think that's what sitting down and taking a breath and really strategizing a little bit can help build that plan that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking about is that when we go to conference, national or regional conferences, you very often see the best and the brightest, and smaller libraries sometimes feel like they just can't accomplish all those grand plans. So I feel very sensitive to those smaller libraries and hope that they don't feel overwhelmed so that they just stop. Does that make any sense to you guys?
I remember attending a regional conference and we were having a smaller academic library present to us, and the title of her presentation was hysterical. It was like, she said, we're on the dull edge of technology. Because, well, they were doing the best that they can.
Yeah, that's right. And if you're a small tech school in a rural area, you may have tons of technology because you're rural. You may have none because there's no money around.
Right.
But you still, there's so many different ways to spin a program.
Right. And I think a lot of times, and this kind of falls into that, when you look at one plan, you're like, oh, look at all these, what these people are doing. And you want to do the same thing at their institution. I always think of and that was what I would always run into when I would look at a plan or what I wanted to have as a component of that plan, is I would have needed 100 librarians to help me teach all the sections that I had in this plan, which was just completely unreasonable.
Oh yeah, they always want us to. We have a credit course, which we did talk about last week. We have a two or three credit courses, but the one that's been around the longest is Library 120, which is Introduction to Information Literacy. And faculty love it, and they wish that we would offer 60 sessions a year. I said, well, we just don't have the staff. That is it. They'll always think this is a great product. Can't you do more of it? We'll say, well, we're running as fast as we can. You'd really just have to look at the big picture.
Well, again, that's the kind of complaint you want, though, is that there's not enough people to keep up with the demand. So right. If they like you that much.
Yeah, give us some more faculty lines and we'll be happy. But the course is very popular. It started out in 1999, and we are still teaching it feverishly. There have been a few years when, with the economic crisis in the country, when we were a little bit low on staffing levels, so we weren't able to teach as many sessions. But the high number was when, I think 2008, 2009, we taught 19 sessions. And most recently, we've been back up to almost 17 sections a year, which isn't a tremendous amount of students because we only take 25 students in a class. I often, we do think about whether it's effective, but it's extremely effective for the students who are in the course, and so we do it happily. But I always think, we're putting so much time into this few hundred students. What could we do that would be meaningful to several hundred students instead, to more students.
That really does sound like a lot of time, though. I mean, if you've got, you said you've got 8 librarians?
Yeah. But what we do, whenever we teach, we hire a quasi-per-course lecturer, but instead of the per-course lecturer teaching the course, they sit on the reference desk and provide reference services so that we can teach. So that every time that we teach, we're getting more hours of librarian staffing, part-time staffing.
Oh, that's great.
Okay. So that flushes out a little bit there.
And Mary, you have a library school on campus, right?
Correct, we do. We're very happy to have that school. And they also participate as partners, I would say, in our programming, because we hire about a half a dozen students to work on our reference desk and to help teach basic instruction classes such as the ORI 101. And also we have a very robust relationship with the writing department and teach probably 120 sessions a year for them. So the grad students help us a great deal with providing those classes. And we also just started a collaboration with a credit course at the library school, which is the information literacy course. Probably had about 12 students in that class this fall, helped to teach URI 101. So once we get the ball rolling and we're trained and we fully understand what the program that we are about to embark on, we also train all these grad students. So there's a continual flow of professional librarians and budding almost librarians who teach these classes. So that helps. And they, again, they're on the reference desk as well. So there's quite a lot of bodies around. It's just that we have 8 faculty librarians.
So I'm sorry, Mary, did you say that those graduate students get to actually teach the 3 credit courses?
No. You know, it would be great, but you'd have to, in fact, I have thought of it, and I know the other schools probably have a setup like this where you could, if you could get a credit class in the library school where a librarian kind of supervised, you know, was the teacher of record, you could teach them how to teach a course, and they could teach the course, and you would be kind of overseeing the whole production, if you will. And I know that the writing department does that, and I can see perhaps in our future doing something along those lines, but it would be a few years out.
Yeah. It's a big time commitment.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be a big deal. We do a lot of, you know, all library school students do a professional field experience. We usually have several grad students who are doing that, and they may choose to focus on instruction or on reference, and occasionally both. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of bodies around, but when you think about who's the responsible party, there's just a kind of a core group of us.
We are experimenting at GSU with some new reference staffing models. We haven't extended it to instruction, but I hope that we will. We've got several staff members who work the reference desk, and we've always had many of those. They don't teach at all, and I think that's a real missed opportunity because we have several staff people who could teach, you know, a freshman English one-shot just perfectly well and perfectly competently, and many of them know more about certainly about GSU's resources than I do because they've been here a lot longer than I have. Mm-hmm. We're starting, I think this semester, or this coming semester rather, spring, is going to be the first time that we will have grad students on the reference desk. I'm not sure if it's at least the first time since I've been here that they've done that. So we're sort of experimenting, and it's really nice because it frees us up, the librarians up, to do other stuff because, you know, we are the only ones who are doing the teaching. So it frees us up to do more instruction and more stuff like that. We've got more people covering the reference desk. But I wish that we would kind of expand that into instruction a little bit and try tinkering with some new models for who's doing instruction here. The sense here is that they only want faculty, librarians, teaching students. And I sort of understand, you know, vaguely why that's the idea, but at least that's how it's been explained to me.
But what about, you know, when I say bread and butter classes like URI 101, where it's a warm welcome and here are our services, I think other staff and grad students are capable of doing that kind of a class.
Absolutely.
And I think, for instance, with our writing program, again, years of collaboration with different chairs of the writing program. And I must say my colleague Jim Kinney coordinates the writing program and has done all of the design of the program, implementation and assessment. So I kind of just keep all the plates spinning at the same time. That's my role. But we've come up with a session that everyone's fairly happy with. And while not scripted, there certainly is a, outcomes you have to meet
There's enough of a lesson plan that somebody else could take over.
Plan, you know, where everyone knows what they've got to get done, and our grad students do a terrific job at meeting those expectations. So I think if it comes to, you know, a 300-level history class, then you're talking a different situation, and you would want your faculty, your professional librarians to do those classes. Because you can't expect a grad student, one, to have as much experience or to have the time to do the prep is another situation for them.
And the other area that it seems to make sense to me, and this is, I mean, absolutely applicable to my institution as well, because we have the same part-timers that work at the reference desk, but they aren't involved in instruction. But we do a lot of workshops, and we don't have anything like the URI 101, and we really rely on those workshops of, like, introduction to the library resources, and to give library tours and all of those. And I think it would really make sense to have, you know, to give those over to the part-timers. So as you said, it'll free up the faculty librarians to work on the more meatier.
Now, Rachel, the workshops, are they drop-in or you have to sign up ahead?
They're drop-in.
How does that? We tried that 1 year, and I was, you know, so excited to give it a go, and I didn't get good results, so I wondered if I was missing a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, it. We try and advertise it as much as we can and do a bunch of them in the first week. But I think, I don't know, I personally am in favor of doing more of a orientation, or even just like a party in the library.
Oh, yeah.
For all the new people, which is the model we moved to at Emory.
I've read some great ones, yeah.
But, yeah, we do get a surprising number of people that come of their own volition, but most of them are not freshmen. And we do other things with the freshmen. We have something.
Well, that goes back to something I mentioned earlier when we used to spend our time with the URI 101 students teaching them how to find a book using our consortium catalog. And if you recall, when we first spoke, I mentioned that I just didn't know how many freshmen really needed to find a book in the first 6 weeks of class. And that's it's extended a little bit now, because it used to be that these one-credit classes were twice a week for the first half of the semester, but they do tend to be longer now. I think a freshman probably just needs to know where everything is. They don't always need in-depth instruction in the first couple of weeks that they're on campus. So it's a tough call to know how can you develop a program that you can roll out among a whole lot of staff that will be meaningful to a whole lot of students. You know, you're never going to meet everyone's needs, but you have to give it a try.
That's what I liked about our orientation at Emory, was that they actually did get what their assignment was, is to go to each of the service desks, and they would get a sticker from each one, and it was up to the desk to decide what they wanted to tell the students about, you know, what they do and why they might come to that particular desk. And then at the end, they would go up to our main room and get entered into a raffle once they had all of their stickers, and then they would get some food, and we had some student groups that were playing music throughout the library, or like putting on performances.
Oh, wonderful.
And then if they did assessment, sat down in our computer lab and did an assessment, they had gotten additional entry into the raffle. So
that's a nice way of doing it. Didn't your service desk get flooded during these sessions? Or
sometimes. We tried to keep our spiels short, and I was only there for the first year, but what was really surprising was that a lot of the feedback, the students said that they actually wanted more content from the desks. They wanted more information than they were given.
Well, that's it. I mean, when we give, we have to find the happy medium. Mm-hmm. We've had that same experience where years ago we were heavy on, you know, getting into subject headings and call numbers, and that now we're at sort of at the other end of the continuum where I think it's great, I love it, but it doesn't meet everyone's needs, because some of the students really do need to get into that more sophisticated stuff right away. So it's tough, because we cannot do a custom class for every session. We just don't have that kind of time. So, I guess when one of us comes up with the perfect class, we can make our millions and retire.
Yep. That's why we got into libraries, right?
To make millions, exactly.
I don't know who's going to give us the millions, but get to wear a crown at any rate.
I think in the end what it comes down to, again, is just making sure that people know where to go for help, because you can't tell them everything, and they won't always come when they need help, but yeah, just trying to, you know, sell yourself as approachable, and we have food, you know.
things. Sometimes I think we blame ourselves for everything, and you have to put yourself in a different reference point. And I don't know if I mentioned this to any of you. I may have said it to Anna once, but that I always tell the graduate students when I'm training them that, you know, if you're new to URI as a grad student, you had to figure out the library yourself. So you can share some of that personal experience with the freshmen, tell them how you felt and how you think these things will help them and blah, blah, blah. Okay. So I said, they're like, well, you know, it's not that hard, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, it's not that hard to figure out. Let's put yourself in a new situation. I tell them a story of one summer when my husband was away working at Boy Scout camp, and I had to get a new windshield wiper for my Ford Escort station wagon. And I was sent to Napa, which is a local auto parts store. I don't know if it's a national chain or not. And I walked in, and all the men had on funny uniforms. They all smelled like grease. Everything was in a box with a code number on it. And I was timid. I said, I don't want to go up to that service desk and ask them for a windshield wiper. I should know how to do this. There must be a secret code. There must be a way. And I thought, that's how every student feels when they walk into the library, you know, brand new situation, books with funny codes on them, people dressed, you know, middle-aged women with tote bags and fire glasses. And, you know, they do the same thing. So we have to put ourselves in their shoes and think about, you know, what is it they need to know so they can get over that hurdle.
Mary, whenever I want a personal equivalent to the freshman information anxiety, I think about my experience with Cars, so I'm right there with you too. Cars completely baffle me. So, well, we've mentioned the book a couple of times. I want to make sure this gets a good plug in because it's such a terrific book, Teaching Information Literacy, 50 Standards-Based Exercises for College Students. This is the second edition. The first edition was how long ago? Remind us.
03.
Oh, three. Okay, so it was certainly due for an update then. A lot's happened in 7 years. But this is really, I liked it a lot because it is so practical. There's so much stuff that you can just sort of almost take straight out of the book and use in a classroom with very little customization required. But every chapter has a different sort of broad topic. What is information, issues in the information age, periodicals, and the web and scholarly research. But it's all really grounded in theory, but you've done a great job of making it very readable and very practical.
Practical,
this is not,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is not abstract theoretical stuff. This is like...
No, I'm a practical girl, and we're pretty practical librarians. We have some theorists among us, but that's never really been my strength. I should be embarrassed to say that. But frankly, I feel like I can jump into a classroom and make it feel real without worrying about what the abstract part is. Now, I liked what you're saying, that you can take pieces of the book and use them separately, because that's really our intention. It wasn't really meant to be a course textbook, although I think you could take pieces of it and get ideas for how to put a course together. But we wanted to share exercises that each of the librarians that have taught our credit course have used in different experiences. And we've shared all of our exercises with each other, and together we have improved them and edited them from year to year. So this is, again, it was time to share what we had developed over the last, 6 years, because we actually, you know, probably had gotten most of it together about a year before it was finally in print. And you'll know if you have had a chance to look at the original, which I don't assume everyone has, there are several more authors included in this book. My colleagues Peter Larson, Amanda Eisenstark, Jim Kinney, and a former colleague, Kate Choromka, who's now working at a hospital library, all have contributed to this new publications in ways that enrich it incredibly. So we're very pleased to have them in the book. And Joanna, of course, has been my co-author for many years. And if it wasn't for Joanna, none of the books would get written, because she's the person who says, these are great ideas, we should get them down and share them. And I think everybody needs someone like that, because I think all of us could write a book. It's just a matter of finding someone to organize it for you. Well, I'm always starting a project and then going on to the next one, you know, so I'm not really the best person to sit down and to write a book.
Boy, follow through is tough, isn't it?
It is tough. And plus, every new idea begets another new idea. So, right. you know how that is.
One of the things about this resource, though, is that I guess I look at it like that, like this nice instructional resource to have. I mean, I'm not in an academic library anymore, but I actually had to go over to the College of New Jersey to look at the copy that they had. They actually rush cataloged it for me. So thank you, College of New Jersey. That was very nice of you. And I was looking through, I'm like, there are some of these things that I could use with some of the, because I'm not necessarily doing, I mean, I do some of the catalogs, some of the databases, but I really do more kind of the transliteracy aspect now. And I was looking at it, I'm like, there are exercises here that I could adapt to what I'm doing in my little classroom. So it really, I think it transcends academic libraries in some ways.
There's a lot
of it. That's really nice.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I've got it in front of me now, and I'm just sort of flipping through it. And there's lots of it that is maybe academic specific, but there's so much of it here that you could adapt really easily.
Absolutely,
to school library.
Yeah.
And some of the, you know, some of the teaching that I know you're doing, Anna, I mean, there's loads of stuff, you know, Wikipedia and just, you know, really research fundamentals here. I think this would be really adaptable.
Right. Yeah.
And assessment. And there's a little bit of talk about, you know, program planning and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I've seen other examples of this kind of book where it's, you know, teaching exercises and so on. But I think this is really my favorite, specimen of the ones that I've seen anyway, just because it's got lots of really, you know, and like I said, very practical, but very down to earth. But, you know, here's the theory behind why you would do this, and here's what students should get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for saying that. I think there's a ton of wonderful, wonderful books out there. And the best thing to do is grab them all, or as many as you can, get your library to buy them. And if you are an instruction librarian, you should have a few of your favorites in your office, because every now and then you get stuck and you just want to either reaffirm that you're on the right track or look for a new slant. And all of the books that do the similar task are very valuable to all of us. And people say, oh, I don't want to write a book because it's all been done before. But I know when I first got into the field, I was buying everything I could lay my hands on just to get me revved up and get kind of in the loop, so to speak.
Mary, I'm going to put you on the spot.
What?
What are your favorite books?
Well, I'll tell you, the primo book is Grassian and Kaplowitz.
Yeah, that's the one that comes to mind for me. Yeah.
Even when I first got in, there were some early, they're probably not that old, but I got into ACRL's instruction section, immediately after I graduated. So when I first went to ALA in 98, I grabbed things at the ALA bookstore, which of course was like Mecca for me, and I went in and grabbed everything I could that had to do with library instruction. And of course, you know, you should always buy the LOEX proceedings. And
those are great.
That's ideas.
Yes.
A ton of ideas.
We'll cite all of the sources that we've mentioned in this episode in the show notes on the blog at adlibinstruction.blogspot.com. If you're listening in your car, wait till you get home to look that up. So. Safety first.
Of course.
Well, I know we're running close to the end of the show. I want to just mention briefly that I got invited last week to talk to an LSU library school class, and I want to give them a brief shout out and thank them for inviting me. Dr. Alma Dawson and my friend Derek Jefferson, who is a student in the class working on his library degree, invited me to come and talk to the class. So I Skyped in, just like we're doing right now, And they had me on a video screen, and I was just – I sort of talked for about 10 minutes about what I do and what it's like to be an information literacy instruction librarian. And they asked me some terrific questions, some of which, you know, really sort of put me on the spot, and I had to think fast. And we had a great discussion, though, and it was really interesting because this was a distance ed class. They had some local students in Baton Rouge, but then they had other students at – I think they have like three satellite campuses, and they had classrooms and video monitors where all the students would come to the classroom, and the instructor is talking to some of the students in the room and some of them via distance, with a camera pointed at her. And then they had, of course, I had a webcam on me, and they had me on yet another screen in the room.
Oh, boy.
And then they had a video camera pointed at the screen in the classroom so I could see whatever student was asking the question. So there, I mean, I think this must have taken like 10 people to set up. But it was really terrific. I had a great time talking to them. They asked me some terrific questions about, you know, library anxiety and interdisciplinarity, and they had clearly been listening to the podcast, so that's why I wanted to give them a little shout out and a thank you, because they asked me some questions about topics that we had talked about before, and just had a great time doing it. So again, Dr. Dawson, thanks for inviting me. Derek, thanks for setting it up.
It sounds like it was fun. I love to visit library school classes because they keep you fresh.
You know, we don't have a library school in Atlanta. There's lots of library students, and you know, as I've mentioned many times, I did my degree by distance ed. But I kind of wish we did. I would love to have, you know, more sort of formalized contact with some library students and have more back and forth going on, because it just seems like from hearing you talk about your interaction with the LIS grad students, Mary, that it just seems like it's a great way to sort of keep new blood going and you know, keep interesting conversations.
Totally. I mean, they will ask you, of course, the types of questions anyone new to the profession asks, and much like Anna's question, what are your favorite books, that they make you stop and think. You know, I might have one idea about, you know, they'll say, well, why do you do it that way? You know, well, why does this librarian answer a reference question one way and someone else does it differently? And I tell them, you know, because they'll be at the reference desk with all the different, the full-time and the part-time librarians. It has a different style. And I say, everyone answers the question, but everyone has their own way of approaching it. And they may know that they've had great experience with certain print or online resources. So I tell them, you know, you just can't memorize the books that are going to give you the answers. You've got to just be fresh and ready to attack. You know what I'm saying? You know, you got to answer the reference question flexibly, because there's a lot of different ways to get it done. So I tell them, learn what the best things from everyone and observe.
That's one of my favorite things, is when someone asks, why do you do it that way? Because I don't think we often think about, why do we do it this way? And that's
right.
And even though it's intimidating having someone watch you teach for an example, they ask, why did you go this route with that? And I'm like, I have no idea.
You know what happened once? This might be boring, but let me tell you this story, because it was eye-opening to me. When I teach my credit class, we have a lesson plan, and it's very rough usually. I mean, I know where we want to go, but I had never learned to make a formal lesson plan. So I'll write on the whiteboard today's agenda, just kind of bullet points, you know. And as I finish them, I erase them. And it's more for me than for anybody else. Then I had a grad student come in and guest lecture one day, and she did exactly what I did. She wrote it on the board, and she erased it. I said, why did you do that? She said, because you do. Well, that's really just to keep me on track. It's not a pedagogy. It's not like a real – she said, well, I think it helps the students know what's coming and where they – you know, what's next. And I'm like, okay, I guess that works. But, it was a silly little thing, but I wondered – everything I do, they're watching.
Yeah.
They have to be really strategic, really careful, you know. So I thought, okay, I hope it helps, because it's a habit I can't stop. So.
Mary McDonald, thank you again so much for being on the podcast, and especially for coming back and being game to do a take two. This will be up soon. This has been episode 20. It's still just barely November 2010, and we're going to have another episode within the next couple of weeks before everybody goes out of town for the holidays.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me and listening.
Thanks so much. Adventures in Library Instruction is produced by Rachel Borcher, Jason Puckett, and Anna Venskoig. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. To subscribe, go to our website at adlibinstruction.blogspot.com. Leave comments and suggestions on the blog or email us at adlibinstruction@gmail.com. Our opening theme song is Dropping Out of School by Brad Sucks, and our closing theme is Higher Education by the Napoleon Bonapartes. Both are available at magnatune.com.
Contact the library schools and the American Library Association. They are able to give you valuable advice.